Over NBC's coast-to-coast network of independent affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable, we present William E. Henry of the Department of Psychology of the University of Chicago. Mr. Henry.
Next week's meeting of the American Orthopsychiatric Association has focused attention on the problems of childhood and adolescence. Today's discussion is devoted to the problem of the adolescent. Joining in on today's roundtable of adolescence in American culture are Miss Helen Ross of the Institute of Psychoanalysis, Dr. Maxwell Gittleson, psychiatrist and member of the staff of Michael Reese Hospital, Mr. Allison Davis of the Department of Education of the University of Chicago. Miss Ross, would you give us a definition of adolescence?
Adolescence is not to be defined in a few words, Mr. Henry, but rather to be thought of in terms of growth, emotional, physiological, and social. You can't talk about it in terms of physiological development alone either, nor by the apparent know-how of conducting oneself in a social situation, which every boy and girl longs to do properly. But you must define it in emotional terms also. Adolescence is the period of transition from childhood to adulthood, as we all know. It's a period of many trials and errors. It is a period of slow growth toward maturity, the maturity which makes the boy or girl both willing and ready and able to leave the dependence of childhood, to take on personal responsibility, to take on responsibility of making a living, of responsibility to government and authority, and responsibility eventually for taking on the building up of another family.
Mr. Davis, is there just one kind of adolescence?
Not at all. We know that adolescent behavior is different in different kinds of social and economic environments. Every human group has to train its children for that particular social and cultural world in which that group is to live. For example, in the lower social and economic neighborhoods, the adolescent boy or girl spends most of his time outside of the home, in the streets, in the theaters, the taverns, the pool halls, the nightclubs. He often earns his own money also. He has a large degree of economic independence, therefore. In slum groups, the adolescent really is a man or a woman in the social and economical sense by the time he is 15 or 16. On the other hand, in the standard middle-class American family, the adolescent has to undergo what I would call a long probationary period before he can attain any of the status of a man or a woman.
Dr. Gilson, when many people think of adolescence, they think only of juvenile delinquency. What about this?
Well, delinquency is certainly an aspect of adolescence, but it is not all of adolescence. There's as much delinquency as we have techniques for discovering. Delinquency is only one of the more resented manifestations of the problems of the adolescent. It originates on the same basis as the other troublesome aspects of a difficult period in life. Delinquency is a product of the individual and his troubles, aided and abetted by the troubles of the society in which he is living. We have to do something about both the individual and his society in order to treat delinquents.
I wonder what, Mr. Davis, you'd say is the general position of the adolescent in today's society.
Well, first, let's look at him physically. The studies of Jones and of McFarland at the University of California and of Havikhurst and Tauber at the University of Chicago have shown, first, that just before adolescence, most children have their sharpest increase in the rate of growth, and they complete most of their growth somewhere around the age of 14 or 15. They are men and women, too, somewhere around this age in the sense of that they are sexually fully developed. Furthermore, it's important for teachers and parents to know that all children do not develop at the same rate of growth. If you have a slow-growing child, he should be reassured that he will, in time, in a year or two, grow faster. And if you have a fast-growing child, he should be reassured that the others will come up to his level so that he will not be too big for his group. Intellectually, the adolescent at the age of 15 has the average intellectual attainment, the average IQ of an adult.
Do you mean by that, Mr. Davis, that he is as intellectually developed as he's ever going to be?
No, I would say only in terms of the kinds of problems that are on intelligence tests. Undoubtedly, as the men and women grow older, they learn the kinds of skills, kinds of insights about life, which really are our problem here.
You mean intelligence and maturity are not the same thing?
Well, not in the sense, I would say, in which the IQ defines intelligence. The maturity and mature intellectual development goes far beyond the ordinary kind of school-typed intelligence. It seems to me, to answer Mr. Henry's question more fully, however, that the basic problem of adolescence is this. While the adolescent is physically and in many ways emotionally a man or a woman, our society insists that he keep childish, really childishly ignorant. Our society keeps him weak in many of the basic areas of life. The average parents know that their children and their adolescents will live in a highly competitive world in America, socially competitive, economically competitive. To prepare their adolescent for this world, there are three main requirements. First, control of sexual and other gratifications. Second, long schooling for 16 to 25 years. Third, postponement of marriage until the educational requirements for a good marriage, as we say, have been completed.
Well, what you say certainly emphasizes a very important aspect of what we see in the adolescent situation, but it's only one aspect of it, because actually we put the adolescent in a dilemma. On the one hand, as you've indicated, we have him controlled and supervised and dependent and in his childhood status for an excessively long period of time. On the other hand, we as parents hold out to him all sorts of competitive goals in terms of our own wishes and strivings, and our society holds out these same competitive goals for him. He really is in the middle. He doesn't know where to turn.
I think this is true. That is, we have a line of high hurdles which the adolescent must be headed toward without losing his stride. To keep him working for these really very distant goals, middle-class culture has found no method, it seems to me, but that of keeping the adolescent dependent, of keeping him in a child status. In our society, we have to keep 16, 17, 18-year-olds who in every respect adults really in the status of children.
Seems to me that the program which many of us listen to, that is Henry Aldridge, is perhaps a good example of what we adults often think of as adolescence, representing a little more what we sort of would like adolescence to be, that is humorous, funny, but still in a dependent position, a position of which, incidentally, we sort of like to make fun.
The inconsistency, though, that Mr. Davis speaks of shows us just what uncertainty we throw the adolescent into. For instance, most fathers and mothers, especially mothers, like to see their boys and girls date early. They want to know that they're going to be popular. Probably they're more interested in popularity, so-called, than they are in the actual dates. While on the one hand, they're urging them into popularity, on the other hand, they feel that the boy and girl should tell them just whom they're going out with, just how long they're going to stay, etc. In other words, we push them on the one hand and we hold them back on the other.
Yes, and these restrictions are really no minor matter. They affect the basic needs of the human adult. For example, the adolescent has to remain economically dependent because he has to go to high school or to college. Being kept economically dependent, he has to remain in the home of the parents and therefore under their supervision. He cannot marry, and thus he cannot have a normal sexual life. because he must complete his education. Thus, our world, owing to its basic career goals, keeps its adolescents basically frustrated and childish, and therefore emotionally dependent, and therefore difficult, I would say, to live with.
But we can't go all the ways over on that either. While it is true that we over-control the adolescent, the fact is that the adolescent does need supervision. He does need the security of his family's stand-by attitude towards him and supporting attitude towards him. It does by no means follow that we simply give him carte blanche and let him go on his own.
I think this is true, that the real problem here is how to give the adolescent a sense of responsibility, which is the main need of an adult, an ability to control himself, and at the same time keep him really on the road toward these long-distant goals.
May I say a word here, Mr. Davis, about the tendency among some families to turn over important decisions to the children themselves? I think we're getting out of this somewhat, but for a while we thought that this was the best pedagogy, to let the children make all the decisions, no matter how important it was to the child's later life, therefore forcing on the child a greater responsibility than he is really ready to deliver.
This, in a sense, represents also some of our own anxieties as parents, it seems to me, that if we can convince ourselves that what we really have to do is force the decisions upon the adolescent, the problems of our of guiding the adolescent become much simpler for us.
It seems to me that the trouble of the average parent is that he feels that he has to guide this development of the adolescent and of the child step by step. That is, literally with 100 different kinds of instructions per day. Whereas I believe you would agree probably, Miss Ross, that the more effective way to help a child learn to become adult is yourself as a parent to win his interest, his sympathy, and to set some kind of example of maturity in one's own life.
And may I say a word there for the parents? It's awfully hard sometimes for them to understand these sort of rebellious acts of independence of the adolescent boy and girl. If they could remember that they're not trying so much to get away from the parents as they are trying to get away from their childhood dependence on the parents, I think they'd feel better about it.
There's another aspect to that, and that is that parents really have to learn to sit or stand with our hearts in their mouths while their children are taking a chance on living. And that's really the thing that they're most afraid to do. I think if they could feel that enough confidence in themselves and what's happened to them to visualize the same boy or girl 10 years later, they wouldn't worry so much about that.
This point that was made a moment ago about the standby qualities of the family seems to me to be an important one. I wonder, what did you mean by that, Miss Ross?
Well, I mean that we have to think of the home perhaps like an emergency landing. The child has to be allowed to go out, explore, get new experience. We want that for every boy and girl. But he's going to run into some things he doesn't understand. He may even run into some trouble. He's got to have sufficient love and feel sufficient love and warmth and understanding from the parents to go back to them and ask for help out of the difficulty. That's what I mean by standing by.
This is not always easy, however, I would say, Miss Ross, for parents, because in this competitive world into which the parent is trying to really push his child, parents suffer themselves from the criticism of their own children. For example, we were talking to an adolescent boy recently, a boy from a slum neighborhood, too, who told us that my old man don't know from nothing. That is, this boy has a feeling, probably through the parents' own pushing of him and also through the desire in America to get up in the world, which is, of course, a fine desire. The boy has a feeling that really He is farther ahead on this line than his own parents, and this is hard for parents to take, I think.
It's also very hard for them to take the feeling that the adolescent boy and girl have usually, that the parents are very old, and therefore they cannot possibly understand.
Yes, that age barrier, I would say, is probably the chief barrier, wouldn't you? It's very difficult for people of widely separated ages really to get into and the experiences of the other group.
What about other institutions than the family? Certainly we can't leave the whole burden of this upon the family.
Well, as a matter of fact, we don't. We depend on the schools. We depend on other leaders in the lives of the children. But I'd like to add that the children themselves don't depend alone on their parents. Probably the person from whom the boy and girl prefers to learn about the next step in growing up is the person just a little bit older than he is, who has already reached that point. A little girl of 15, or let us say a girl of 15, said to me not long ago, if I could plan families, I would plan it so that everybody has a big sister. She saw immediately how funny this was and then added, but you see, then I would know just what was going to happen to me next, and I'd be ready for it.
Well, we have to be careful in referring to extrafamilial assets for our children to grow up with, not to overburden the assets, the few assets that we have at the present time. We may expect too much from our schools and our community organizations as they exist to provide what the adolescent ought really to have in the way of extrafamilial stimuli and supports.
I think in that connection, the schools can learn from the play group, the group of children and adolescents of the same age. For example, Carolyn Tryon has pointed out that the age group of the adolescents, the school group of children, does not lecture. That it teaches the main adjustments which the adolescent has to make, really, socially, without any lecturing or badgering. It does it by setting a kind of popularity model, which every child yearns and every adolescent yearns to imitate. Now, teachers need to learn much of this themselves, that they cannot control adolescents. They cannot keep the lid on, which is the aim in so many high schools. But they have really to enter into the ideals, the aspirations, the individuality of adolescent boys and girls, and in this way guide them.
Seems to me also that many other of the institutions in our own society have that added role of providing the adolescent not so much with precise learning or with educational devices, but with a certain amount of emotional substance, of emotional support, which doesn't, in the direct educational sense, teach the adolescent some precise techniques, but what gives him the support and the confidence, perhaps, to do his own experimentation, to learn by, in a sense, living as an adolescent.
On this point of the school, I've been in about 500 classrooms the last 4 years, and I find there the same kind of competitive emphasis that one finds in the child's training in the family. That is, in the schools, as Warner, Haverhurst, and Lowe have pointed out long ago, there is a status system just as in the total community, and the child is rated and judged according to these same traits that the parent has in mind when he tries to make him well-mannered and well-educated and so on. It's very difficult to overcome in training adolescents, therefore, this main backbone of American society, which is really competition.
Dr. Gilson, I wonder what you'd say about the attitude of many parents, that is, a sort of laissez-faire attitude of, well, we'll let the adolescent figure it out for himself.
Well, that's probably characteristic in the full only of the most progressive and ultra-modern parents, because parents would have, in general, on the basis of their own feelings, a great deal of difficulty in taking such a completely laissez-faire attitude towards their adolescents. And as I've mentioned before, Actually, the adolescent doesn't want complete freedom. He wants to have the opportunity to be as free as he feels secure in being, and then when his security comes to an end, when his own security comes to an end, he has to know that there is someone, and that is the parent, who can support and carry him through.
It must have been much easier in primitive societies, and in primitive societies that still exist today, when there was a quite sharp definition between being a child and an adult through ceremonies, and so there was a certainty about how one should behave. The uncertainty of adolescence is probably the root of their rather conservative behavior in conforming to the gang, which we see so prevalent today.
That's a point I think is sort of important. We as adults have the idea of adolescence as being very wild, sowing their own wild oats, being rebellious, and so forth. And now, here you're saying really what the adolescent is up to is being conservative. I wonder what is this a contradiction in terms here?
No, not at all. The conservativeness of the adolescent is not really conservative in the sense of politics. It's in the sense of discovering a way of living and at the same time having sufficient support for that new way of living. And he gains that new way of living and support for that new way of living from his peers, from his fellows, and those who are a little older than he. He is conservative relative to what he and his fellows are discovering together as a way of living so that they have a common front.
Yes, I'd like to emphasize one point there. It isn't just the people who are older, just the peers that help him make these decisions, as we well know, and Dr. Gittleson would add. It's the family also. But I'd like to point out that there are, for instance, in Europe today, thousands and thousands of children who never had this backbone of family guidance. And so if you'll let me, I'll speak one word about the adolescent in Europe today who lived his young childhood in that period when there was probably very broken up family life. Maybe he's never experienced it. Therefore, he has not learned the responsibility to an individual which prepares him for later responsibility. He may be, let us say, the most vulnerable person in Europe today. He may be the political pawn of the future.
That's also true of children in our own country who have had comparable experiences, children from broken homes, children who have been brought up in institutions and so on. They present the same psychological problem.
Yes,
and have
they do.
To be dealt with accordingly.
Seems to me that one of the problems of adolescent idealism really is how this may be combined with social responsibilities, a sense of responsibility, which is what the adult world requires. And one reason the adolescent is a dreamer, in a sense, is that he looks both back upon his childhood and forward toward a world when childhood pleasures and dreams will meet a reality which is not always beautiful. I think there's a certain pathos in adolescence, therefore, because it's kind of last stopping place before one has to face adulthood.
I wonder what is this altruism and idealism that we hear of so much in adolescence?
Well, I was thinking, as Dr. Davis spoke, of the thoughts of youth are long, long thoughts. And many of the long thoughts are concerned with things far away. When the boy and girl is having some difficulty, let us say, in his interpersonal relationships within the family, he often turns to broader fields and makes up ideas of utopias and how the world should really be run. Now, some of this altruism and idealism can be called perhaps an escape from his present difficulties, but we shouldn't stop at that. This is really a force within the adolescent that can be put to constructive use. To laugh at it may be to destroy it. Teachers and wise teachers and leaders and parents will not regard these ideas as sophomoric and Henry Aldrich-like, but rather as something to capitalize on and develop in their children.
Dr. Gillison, I wonder about the other part of this, the delinquency aspects of the adolescent problem.
Well, strange as it may be, Mr. Henry, the delinquent may also be an idealist. He often patterns himself after somebody whom he admires very much in his particular community, and in which the standards of conduct are different from the community you and I may live in. The fact is that delinquency is only one other way for an adolescent attempting to solve his relations to himself, his relations to his parents, and his relations to a society. And I think it's been correctly said that in many instances a community or a society deserves the delinquency it has.
I wonder also here if we've been talking about a society deserving its own delinquency and about a society which in a sense creates its own problems. Is it not true that our own society is one that makes a particular point of making the individual himself decide his own future, make him, in a sense, internalize and to take onto himself the values of that particular society? We provide, as Miss Ross has really already pointed out, comparatively few guidelines for our adolescent. We tell him what the overall goals should be. We tell him that he should be competitive, and in addition to which we say he should be successfully competitive. But we rely primarily upon his believing this and his developing a code that will take him through it without telling him just what it means, without giving to him the definition of this particular developmental stage.
Well, Miss Henry, is this not what our democracy also is? It becomes the responsibility of the individual to determine what is best for himself and others.
I would certainly think so. The difference in many situations in which we have primarily a highly hierarchical and authoritarian situation is one where not only the techniques of living from day to day, but the overall goals are determined. This system set up these values and tell the individual how to get to them, how to live by them, and hence, by implication, what not to do and what not to believe. Mr. Davis.
It seems to me, then, that we agree, really, that the adolescent, and probably his parent, too, are in a kind of box. On the one hand, the culture demands the child be trained for difficult skills and distant goals. On the other hand, every parent wants his child to have a happy, a well-organized personality. Now, in choosing between these two goals, a parent, I think, has to make up his mind whether or not he will put the emphasis more on getting a child, an adolescent, without too great a level of anxiety, or whether he will try to drive his child toward what we call success, but what might well not be success when he's 40 or 45 years old.
Many of our efforts to drive children toward successful completion of this task are presented to these children not only in their family situation, but in the school situation where, Mr. Davis.
I would say our sympathy then lies with the parent. We feel that the parent should not be too anxious about the difficult problems that he faces, and that in the long haul the child will come out well if the parent looks at him calmly and with consideration, considering what he is facing in the total culture.
Thank you, gentlemen. You have been listening to the University of Chicago Roundtable discuss adolescence in American civilization with Miss Helen Ross of the Institute for Psychoanalysis, Dr. Maxwell Gittleson, psychiatrist and member of the staff of Michael Reese Hospital, Chicago, Allison Davis of the Department of Education, and William E. Henry of the Department of Psychology, both of the University of Chicago, as participants. This week's roundtable pamphlet includes the full text of today's discussion, reading lists, special materials, and questions for analysis and discussion. You will want to receive this pamphlet and to study the special supplementary materials on the problems of adolescence. Be sure to write for your copy and send 10 cents in coin with your order to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. For $3, you may subscribe to the pamphlet for a full year and receive 52 weekly issues. I'll repeat the address, University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. Next week, the roundtable will discuss cancer research today. And now, a special announcement.
Through NBC's University of the Air, the University of Chicago Roundtable offers a new adventure in ideas. You can now combine roundtable listening and specialized study in two roundtable home study courses on world politics and economics in the modern world. These two courses offer each roundtable listener a library of authoritative reading material. These courses give you personal, individualized instruction through 14 lessons in a program of study which you complete.